Excuse me. Thank you for being here tonight. I appreciate the folks that have come to visit with us as well. It's good to be in an assembly like this and again sing together like we have. I appreciate the encouragement. I need it, and you've helped me, and I thank you for that. It's good to see all of you that have come, and some folks that have maybe here tonight for the first time during the meeting, and some of you that we've known and we have a special affection for because of work at other times, other places. And it means a lot to Betsy and I for you to come and encourage us and be a part of our lives as much as possible. Titled the lesson tonight is Are We Worldly Minded? I think I said earlier in the week this could be a short sermon. I'm going to disappoint you. And the answer to that would be yes. Sometimes I feel like Isaiah. Woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell among a people of unclean lips. It's hard for us to say that we don't have any problem with the subject of worldliness, of materialism, of things we're going to talk about tonight. Because we live in a culture that's the name of the game. I have preached sermons similar to this, and I've entitled some of those sermons, A Sermon About Nothing. I hesitate to do that because that will let some of you have way too much fun. I've preached some sermons, I'm sure, after it got done, were about nothing. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain, verse number 6. And verse number 7, our brother and apostle Paul wrote Timothy, For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. So our birth and our death have one thing in common, nothing. Every now and then it's good for us to be reminded of a very simple fact. That when we leave this world, there'd be no car keys, no titles to any homes, no trophies, no awards, no money, no collectibles, nothing. Not even King Tut took anything with him. All of his stuff gets carted all over the world now so we can go look at it. Even though the Egyptians thought that they were burying it with them so they could enjoy it in the afterlife. We need points of reference. We need times in our life we just stop and think about the very simplest of principles stated in Scripture. We came into the world with nothing. We leave with nothing. So what do we do in the meantime? What do we do with the money and the stuff and the opportunities to have a whole lot of fun in this world in the meantime? I've thought about the movie, Remember the Titans, and if you remember, there was a scene there where Coach Boone has met the players for the first time, and Petey, the running back, is standing there with a big smile on his face. By the time Coach Boone got done with him, Petey wasn't smiling anymore. He started off by saying, Why are you smiling? Well, football's fun. And when he got done, he said, Football's not fun, sir. And so I'm going to begin tonight by trying to take all the fun out of life. And then put some enjoyment back in. And this is a dangerous sermon for me to preach because there's too many people in this audience that know me. And there will be some points that I will make tonight that you would be fully justified in your mind if you start thinking to yourself, Physician, heal yourself. I want you to know something, that if this is not one of our greatest concerns, I'm not even sure we're even aware that we're in a battle. If we were in a battle somewhere and the front's way over there and that's where the fighting's going on, but we're over here, you know, doing something else and our fellow soldiers are over there fighting and we're completely unaware that's where we need to be, then we're not of any help over here and eventually we'll lose the battle. So there's a struggle. There is a battle. We need to know where the front is. And I want to share with you tonight some very candid ideas and thoughts. And I hope some application of Scripture that I have tried to do better at living myself. And making sure I remember that I came into the world with nothing. And I will leave with nothing. What happens in between then our birth and our death? Matthew chapter 6. I don't think it's an accident when Jesus begins teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. And he has a lot to say about treasures and things of this world and things of the world to come. He begins by saying in verse 19, I'll not read all of this, but do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Listen, if we could just let verse 21 sink in. The truthfulness of that statement. Even though there are times in my life, I am sure I've tried to deny it the best that I could. Try to cover it up. But you can't hide it. You can't hide it. It has a way of exposing our real loves, our real devotion. Because then in verse 24, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God in money, or mammon, or riches. Can't do it. And so he goes on through the rest of that text, trying to convince his disciples, stop worrying about all of this stuff. And don't even worry about the stuff you need. Because God will take care of you if you do what? If you seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. In the parable of the sower, there's part of that parable that ought to cause us a great deal of concern. We may not have a problem with the first and the second one, and we may all like to think we're the good soil, and I would like to think that we are, or at least trying to make sure we are, cultivating the soil, make sure it's good. But that third one concerns me. Because in Mark chapter 4, in his account of the parable, verses 18 and 19, now these are the ones, let me slow down there and let you turn over there if you're turning over there or looking it up on whatever electronic device you're using. When Jesus was explaining the parable, verse number 18, now these are the ones sown among thorns. They are the ones who hear the word, and the cares of this world, and deceitfulness of riches, and the desires for other things entering in, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. We ever struggle with that one? As I think about this study and I consider the passages that we're going to look at and have already looked at in the first century context, it helps me feel a little bit better, I guess, in some kind of strange way, to wonder what did our first century brethren have to wrestle with? What did they have to deal with when you're thinking about riches and desires of other things and the cares of this world? I guess there were occasions where there was some interest about what was playing down at the local theater. If you lived in Ephesus, you could have gone to a theater that has been estimated to have been able to see 25,000 people. And they would have had to make decisions about sometimes the content of the plays that were being shown. Maybe the other time, maybe was there a play every week, every weekend? To play on Saturday night? Did they have to make some decisions about whether we're going to go to that or not and be ready to get up and worship the next morning? I'd like to think that maybe they had some of those concerns. What about us? What about movies and music and concerts? I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and Betsy and I, we live there and enjoy some country music and bluegrass. I believe if we wanted to, we could probably find a venue, some of them I wouldn't go to, and others that I think would be okay for a Christian to go to, that would be playing bluegrass just about every night. And what about television? How many channels do you have on your TV? There was a commercial a few years ago, I think, for Dish or Direct, one of those satellite, and the guy standing there, and he's watching the guy put it up, and he comes down there, and, you know, guys don't normally do this, but he walked up and just hugged the guy that just installed the dish and said, "I love you." He was just all set now that he had however many channels. We have to make some decisions. In the first century, they may have had to make some decisions about going to the Colosseums and to watch the chariot races. Maybe that was first century NASCAR. I don't know. Or Indianapolis, maybe open wheel racing. I wonder if the gladiator contests, if our football and hockey sometimes isn't beginning to rival it in some ways. Let's go watch the boxing matches or the running races. Paul refers to those things. The Isthmian Games were held in Corinth every 2 years. There were other places where games were held. Number of sports back then, but now think about our day and time. ESPN now is 24 hours a day. And I think just about anything's become a sport now. What about books in the first century? Did they have opportunity to read books? Apparently they did. There was a major book burning at Ephesus in Acts 19. Books that Christians didn't need to have around anymore once they became followers of Jesus. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 12, "With the making of many books, there is no end." I begin to realize that when I go into a Books a Million or Barnes or Noble. We have a bookstore near the church building called McKay's. There's three of them, one in Knoxville and one in Chattanooga and Nashville. It's a preacher's paradise. It's a used bookstore where you can turn books in and buy books. And it's just, I've taken some friends there and they go in and they go, "Wow." You spend a lot of time there. How much are we going to read? How about let's go shopping down at the Agora in the marketplace? There were first century malls. How about going to the gym and work out? I saw some pictures of women working out in a painted picture that was dated about 300 AD. I guess they took vacations back in. Did they go see the pyramids 2,000 years ago? Was that a big deal to make the trip to Egypt? Did they go to South Italy, to Sicily, that may have reminded people today of New Orleans? I don't know if travel and vacation was a big business back then, but I know in our time it is a huge business. I'm saying all of the same. In the first century, these passages were applicable to them too, because they had things that were not wrong in and of themselves, and that's what we're talking about tonight. The things in and of themselves can be something that can be enjoyed, but when does a Christian decide that's too much? And when do the greater things, the more important things, get laid aside because of the things of this world that sometimes entice us so much? I believe that we need now and then to go back and read the book of Ecclesiastes. I believe it's a good book to start with some folks as an initial Bible study. Because sometimes some people just need to wake them up to realize that this is not it. And that what this world is not about is stuff. And a couple of things I certainly have learned from Ecclesiastes, as you have too, is that we're not to get attached to stuff. That's one of those places where, I tell you what, Gary Henry has said in a sermon publicly that he knows one person more nostalgic than him. I'm not sure I ought to tell you this. He referred to me one time as a little old lady dressed up as a gospel preacher. Did that publicly, believe it or not. I admit I'm nostalgic. Now, I'm not a hoarder. But I like to hang on to stuff. I can get through my house. There are no paths through the stuff. But once I have somebody give me something, you'll come in my house and you'll look in my office and you say, "What is all this?" I said, "It didn't cost me anything, but it's stuff people have given me. And now I have an attachment to it, stuff my kids made." About 2 or 3 weeks ago, my dad I was at the house and where he, mom and dad's house, now that he's remarried and lives another somewhere else, but we were in their basement and he got all this American Flyer train stuff that he bought for me at a yard sale when I was about 10 years old. And some of it has never been taken out of the boxes. And he said, "Here, please get this out of the basement. Do something with it." And I'm like, "I don't want this stuff, believe it or not." Now, I've got some things that I'll hang on to. But we had a yard sale a while back, and I was trying to get some people interested in buying some of that. And I found myself looking at some of that thinking, "I'm not sure I want to sell that." You know, it's kind of like a yard sale. When you have a yard sale and you're selling your kids' toys, and they find those toys, and they're out there playing with them, begging you not to sell them. But I want to tell you something. You're going to leave it all behind someday. We're going to leave it behind to folks who won't care about it. I'm not sure either of my kids care about electric trains. And so it'll be sold in yard sales and estate sales and auctions and taken to Goodwill, and the government will get its share. It may be picked through by the American pickers or bid for in storage wars. Or it may just go to the county dump. And that aggravated Solomon. Sometimes I feel his pain, even though certainly none of us would think ourselves as wealthy as he was. But when he came to realize that all of this hard work that he had put into everything that he had in and around his house, around his mansion, he said in verse 17, "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Why? Then I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to a man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will rule over all of my labor in which I toiled, and in which I have shown myself wise under this sun. This also is vanity." I think Solomon also reminds us, and I'm not going to spend as much time perhaps as I would like, but in several passages in Ecclesiastes, what I want you to remember right now, and I don't have to make this the main point of the lesson, but I think some point or another we have to learn, and I think we do, that things, these nothings, will never bring lasting happiness and satisfaction. Never will. I go back to chapter 1 and verse number 8, and Solomon said, "All things are full of labor, the man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." Chapter 2, 1 through 12, he talks about, again, all of these things that he, laughter, enjoyment, fun, parties, and I'm not sure necessarily drunken parties, I don't necessarily get that picture from the text. But then the making of gardens and pools, and then having special servants and having musical instruments. Listen, Solomon didn't have to pay a ticket for a concert. He just had him come to the house and perform for him. He had all that he wanted, he thought. And again, at the end of the day, he says, "There's no profit under the sun. All of that was vanity." I'm afraid our national motto in America sometimes is "have fun." I saw a bumper sticker a while back that said, "If it's not fun, why do it?" I'm here to tell you there can be a lot of things in life you'll have to learn to do that won't be fun. And I think there's a lot of people that have decided, "If it's not fun anymore, I can walk away from it. My marriage is not fun anymore. Parenting is not fun anymore. The church is not fun anymore. My work is not fun anymore. I'll just won't cut it, will it?" There's a place, and I'm taking the fun out, and I'll put a little bit more back in a little while, but music and food and entertainment and sports successes never bring total satisfaction. Never do. How many of you Indiana fans are satisfied with the fact that Indiana's won 5 national championships? I will tell you, as an Indiana fan, I'm quite actually kind of tired of listening to that. 1987 was a long time ago. I'm ready to win another one right now. And you win one, and I heard about Coach Saban in Alabama, that his wife was asked after winning the national championship how long did he enjoy it. She said about 24 hours. And he's right back in the office thinking about how he's going to get it done the next year. It doesn't last. I can tell you that I've never listened to Take It to the Limit by the Eagles and thought to myself, I don't care if I ever hear that song again. And I can tell you I've never eaten some really good barbecue and thought to myself, I'll never have to eat barbecue again. Enjoy it for the moment, but it doesn't take care of my desires forever. It's not intended to do that. There was a tennis player years ago, back before these young people time. She would beat players like Chris Everett, Martina Navratilova. Her name was Hanna Mandakova. And she was asked one time what it was like beating those best players in the world. She said, any big win means that all the suffering, the practicing, the traveling are worth it. I feel like I own the world. And then she was asked, how long does that feeling last? She says, about 2 minutes. Not every day I quote Jim Carrey. But I heard Jim, I read Jim Carrey write a quote in Reader's Digest a few years ago. I think everybody, he said, I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so that they can see that it's not the answer. My friend Gary Henry wrote that the major mistake that many of us make nowadays, however, is thinking that healing comes from pleasure. Sometimes some of these are escape mechanisms. We've got pain and challenges and difficulties in our life that we need to be taking to God. We need to be sharing with our brethren. We need to have such a relationship with God that we're pouring our hearts out to God, but we're trying to cover it up and ignore it by going out to eat, going shopping, going to listen to music, all of that. But eventually the pain's still there. And what causes it may still be there, and you've got to deal with it. And I believe if we learn to deal with it in the godly kind of way, we find some help. And Gary went on to write that wounded and world-weary, we throw ourselves into mirth, merriment, and sensual indulgence, some sinful things, obviously, to seeking to drown our sorrows. But he said Billy Graham was right when he said, the river of pleasure, though it flows through lush meadows and beautiful glens, contains no healing for the soul. When true healing is what we need, mere pleasure will not suffice. We are grasping for wind. I was sitting in the pew a while ago and realized that I got here in my notes, I forgot a prop. And I'm sorry I forgot it. But I meant to bring a jar that I've at the house with a lid on it that I wanted to bring here and tell you that the other day when it was real windy, I went outside and caught some Indiana wind. And I screwed the lid on it real fast. And I was going to bring the lid here. I was going to take the lid off and hold it and ask you if you felt the wind or not. These guys are looking at me like I'm nuts. That's exactly what they ought to be doing. And that's exactly the way we ought to be looking at ourselves. And we think this world satisfies the greatest longing we have by trying to catch Indiana wind in a jar. Can't do it. And we need to remember that. I need to remember that. I need to learn that. I'm going to get myself in trouble before the night's over, but I'm going to talk about working to pay for our toys. I cannot tell you where the line is on how much is too much work, okay? 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours. I can't do that. In fact, there are two or three things tonight. Obviously, I cannot draw the lines for you. But I want you to think about a couple things with me. I know a man who at one time in his life, with five children, worked two jobs, 130 hours a week. You're thinking, how do you do that? Fireman and a truck driver. So he may have been getting some sleep at the fire station. He told me once, he said, I wanted my kids to have everything I didn't have when I was a kid. And eventually he moved on to just making sure they had things. He had an airplane, bought an airplane, owned an airplane, had condos in Gatlinburg that eventually lost. As far as I know, one of those children may be faithful. He was telling me that one night at our table, and I looked at his wife's face, and I wish you could have seen her face. It was a face of just deep hurt. But she was the one left to raise those kids while he was working 130 hours a week. Guys, I understand responsibility and role to make sure we can support our families, and especially if we can, in the best of circumstances, have our wives at home with the children. But sometimes it gets in the way, doesn't it? we can become workaholics. Even preachers sometimes. And the saddest stories I know. This young lady one time said that she could remember eating supper with the entire family twice in her 18 years. Her daddy was a gospel preacher. I like this story. Ray Pritchard tells the story of a conversation between a hard-driving corporate attorney and a professional fisherman friend whom he found teaching his two young sons to catch crabs. "Why aren't you out fishing?" he asked. "Because I've caught enough fish for today," his friend replied. But the attorney said, "Well, why don't you catch more fish than you need?" And the fisherman replied, "What would I do with them?" And then he said, "Well, you could earn more money. You could buy a better boat. You could catch more fish. Then you could buy a fleet of boats and soon be rich like me." And the fisherman said, "Well, what would I do then?" And the attorney friend said, "Well, then you could sit down and enjoy life." And the fisherman replied, "What do you think I'm doing right now?" How do we tell what our priorities are? Didn't take long. I still try to use the checkbook illustration. Checkbooks are going to be obsolete one of these days. But all we got to do is look at our checkbook and our schedule book. How we spend our time and our money and our energy says it all. My brother Kevin Kay said we need to be careful of the pursuit of any one of the what he calls the pernicious P's. Profession, position, power, prestige, profits, possessions, pastimes, pleasure, projects, or politics. As Christians, we need to demonstrate to the world an attitude of contentment, and that seems to be a challenge for us. I've talked about some of these things, and I've had brethren come up to me and say, "You know, Lee, but it's still not wrong to try to better your situation." And I don't always know how to answer that. I understand that. I don't know that to have more because you're doing better at your work is necessarily a bad thing. But I certainly know in Hebrews 13 and verse number 5 that my conduct is to be without covetousness. The old King James says conversation, and I understand that means more than just what we say. But what does our speech say about our desires? Are we always wishing we could do this or that or have this or that? And is it a message we're communicating to the people we work with, to the people we worship with, and to our own families? One of the things we've used as a gauge over the years is what we will miss the assemblies to do otherwise. And I know I'm preaching this on the wrong night. I thought about preaching this sermon on Sunday mornings. But I tell you, in our day and time, that alone says more about us than some of us want said about us. What we will choose to do otherwise than assemble. But it does more than just keep us from assembling, but eventually the worldliness affects our love for and desire to worship. We cannot love this world and God at the same time. And I've got to tell you that sometimes the reason we struggle to come in here and to keep our hearts and minds on things above for about an hour, we can't spend the rest of the week thinking about any and everything but the Lord and His work. And then come in here and flip the switch and all of a sudden we become spiritually minded. It's not going to happen. What about our daily walk with the Lord? What about our prayer time? What about our meditation time? What about our study time? Do we love this book? Are we finding time to read and think and study and pray to this God who has died for us? Jesus who's died for us, and that someday we're going to stand in His presence and give account for how we've offered our lives up to Him as living sacrifices. A friend of mine years ago had just obeyed the gospel, and we were playing basketball on Tuesday nights, and I called him up. I said, "Hey, we're getting together to play basketball. You're welcome to come." He said, Lee, I don't think I can this week. I'm trying to read my Bible every night. I haven't got that done, and I just want to be able to do that. Wow. Justin Dobbs, who preaches in Boston, in a report a few years ago, said, Kent and I are studying Ecclesiastes. I have hope for him, as he recently turned down free hockey tickets because it meant canceling our Bible study. He chose not to break his commitment to meet me to read God's Word. I have forgotten to ask Justin how Kent's doing. Hard for me to imagine a guy like that who hasn't gone on to become a Christian and loves the Lord. And that's in Boston, by the way, or the Boston Bruins, where hockey's a big deal. He turned them down to read, of all books, Ecclesiastes. How do you react when things don't go your way? How do you react when worldly things don't go your way? How do you react when your favorite team doesn't win? Uh-oh, I'm going to get close to home. Especially when it's your child's basketball team. How do you react? I told you I have struggled with worldliness, especially sports. I'll tell you this story just to make you smile, but I hope I'm growing up. When Betsy and I lived in Columbus, believe it or not, you're going to ask, you had season tickets to Indiana football? Why? You know, but they were actually pretty decent between 1988 and 93. Decent's an 8-4 year at IU. But in 1987, they were 5-1. And I was thinking, I'm going to go to the Rose Bowl. Because that didn't happen very often that they go to the Rose Bowl. And they were playing Illinois. And I'm watching the game Saturday afternoon, away game, obviously. And this is the reason I never liked Jeff George. Indiana had a double-digit lead, about 10 minutes to go in the game late in the fourth quarter. And George led Illinois on two scoring drives. And they scored twice there in the last few minutes and ended up winning the game. I went outside. This is 87, so this is pre-kids, B.C., before children, about a year before children. And I went outside and started raking leaves. I'm sure there were two or three on the ground still. And Betsy come outside, what are you doing? I said, please just go back in the house and don't bother me. I don't know how long it took me to get over that. It's not very important, is it? To my parents, are we raising spiritually minded or worldly minded children? It's tough. Sports and entertainment. As parents, one of the challenges is set limits. And not just on the content, folks, not just on what we're watching, the content, but how much we watch and listen to or do. Do you have to set limits on the amount of things your kids engage in? I don't know how some of us will do it when you've got three or four kids and they're all playing soccer and baseball and mom's taxi service. I've had people tell me that we want to keep them busy. Busy doing what? Sometimes so busy that spirits are gross, not a part of the picture. And we need to make sure as parents that they're not simply following our example and that we're not actually the ones encouraging them to get involved in all of these sports, because really it's a vicarious thing. If we would admit it's a matter of pride, we kind of get excited when our kids do well and everybody in the stands goes, looks at Johnny, look how good he's doing. And I'm sitting over there going, yeah, that's my son. We need to make sure that's not the motive. The challenge is to keep this world in perspective. I know that. We have a fellow that played baseball for a year at Ohio State. And then he got cold, went back south, played at Tennessee Tech. And he's one of our members. He and his wife, Nancy, have three kids. He told me that his kids were playing baseball 6 or 7 years old. He had parents asking him how to handle recruitment. Parents of 6 and 7 year old kids. Are we getting a little bit ahead here? How are we going to handle it when Johnny's being recruited by Ohio State or Tennessee Tech? And I will tell you, Brian has three kids, and he loves ball, and all of them are playing. And I had, by the grace of God, enough courage a while back to look across the table at Brian and say, Brian, I just want to remind you something, please. When they're 23 and 24, there'll only be one thing that will matter to you. Are they faithful to Jesus? You have all the trophies in the trophy room, all the batting titles, and maybe even a college scholarship that will help you, your kids. And if you've got four kids, I can understand why you want them to have scholarships. The price of college. But that's what will matter most. And I see too many parents that right now the kids are not faithful. And I think this was one of the problems. I told you a while ago that I share a little bit with you and make this a confessional, but I had a little bit of success. Sports was my life. When we went through Seymour the other day on the way up here, I looked in that little field that when I was 5 years old must have looked like Lucas Oil Stadium, where I played flag football and t-ball and played basketball. We moved to Bedford when I was 10 years old. And hey, I'm a Hoosier. I'm born in Indiana. You got to play basketball, right? And it got started in junior high. And by the time I was in high school, it was football. And the last game was over. Tryout for basketball. And before basketball season was over, I was out working on my throwing as a discus thrower and shot putter. And sports was a big deal to me. I sat by the radio and listened to Indiana Pacers game, kept score back in the ABA days. Listened to the Cardinals and kept a scorebook of the Cardinals because my grandmother and grandpa were St. Louis Cardinals fans. Sports is a big deal. I had a little success as a discus thrower. Allowed me to go to Western Kentucky and for them to pay a little bit of my education. Not a lot of it, but enough of it that was helpful. And people will ask, is it worth it? You know, all the good things we learn in sports. I'm going to tell you a couple things. Now, what that got me was a whole lot of time around a lot of worldly people. Now, I had some good high school coaches that didn't cuss, believe it or not. You can actually coach without cussing. Do you know that? And some decent fellas, some fellas that were helpful to me. When I got to college, it changed. And then, of course, now I'm around guys. I'm in a whole different environment. There were times that wasn't good for me, and there were times I lived in a way that wasn't consistent with New Testament teaching, with Jesus. In fact, I became so competitive at one point, I decided I was talked into some of my teammates to use anabolic steroids, and I used them for 5 weeks. You're going to bear with me a little bit, and I'll tell you. One of the things I wonder if this is providence. My sister and a friend of hers came down to spend the night with me in my apartment, and I left. And when I came back, I didn't know this till some time, but they thought somebody was trying to break in the door, so they went over to my dresser and pulled the top drawer out of my dresser and moved that dresser over in front of the door. Top drawer of that was that bottle of, I can't remember what the name of the steroid was. She called my mom, who has been the biggest supporter I've had. She's the reason that I became an athlete. It wasn't my dad. And they came down that weekend. I had a track meet at Western. And my mom would not get out of the car and watch me. And my dad came over to the throwing circle and he said, son, I want to know something. I want to know how far you can throw. I knew exactly what he meant. That was the last steroid I ever took. It just became too important to where I ended up doing something illegal. I'm thankful I did as little as I did. Are our priorities changing as we get older? I hope so. I hope as we spend our later years, we won't spend them lamenting that we can no longer do what we used to do. I don't want to hear people talk about they can't travel in their RVs anymore and take the vacations they used to take. I want to hear you talk about how great it is going to be to go to heaven. Shouldn't these years be spent in the joy of the hope of heaven? Do we really have the attitude of the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 1, who longed to be with his God, verses 21 through 24, but he said, "You know, if I am to remain, I'll remain for your good, for your benefit, the Philippians." I hope the reason we would want to continue to live is to be able to work in the Lord's kingdom. I wonder sometimes if our attitude is, let's have all the fun we can have here, and then we'll go to the ultimate fun. As my brother Bob Crawley said years ago, I think some brethren believe that heaven is where all the lakes are stocked with hungry fish. Chris, he was to ask me, I was fishing with today and it didn't go so well. Wasn't as good as sometimes. Or where all the golf greens funnel into the hole. A hole in one on every par three. What's the movie Ice Age and their little clip in that with a little critter? I can't remember what it was. Was it a squirrel? But anyway, chasing that acorn. And he's trying to get all these acorns together. But at the end, you know what he really wanted? The golden acorn. And all of that doesn't end up well. And I'm going to tell you, it doesn't end up well for us. I've had older people tell me that Ecclesiastes, the study of Ecclesiastes, is depressing. It is if we have the worldly mindset that Solomon had and we don't end up where he was at the end of the book. I even find older Christians, and I know this, that are surprised by the problems of old age. I wonder if we expect to live to be 90, healthy, then die in our sleep while we're on vacation at our favorite place. Or maybe even after we made the hole in one on the golf course. Didn't work that way, and Solomon said that in Ecclesiastes 12, didn't he? And I want to tell you something, as here's what we want to leave our children: spiritual legacy. Spiritual legacy of character, of devotion to family and faithfulness and convictions to the truth of God's Word and the memory that we died with hope. I still worry sometimes my kids remember me for, you know, my interest in Indiana basketball or this or that. My daughter the other day found a magazine of train rides in Colorado. You know, it made me feel good, the fact she found it, saw it, sent it to me. We've been to Colorado a couple times and taken two or three of the train rides out that way. But I wonder sometimes, am I going to be remembered for those things? Or am I going to be remembered for the faith with which I serve my God? Folks, we've got to make some Mary-like decisions in a Martha kind of world. It's about realizing sometimes what's most needful. Sometimes it's about making choices between good and best. Sometimes, do I fix supper or do I sit down with Jesus and hear His words? Nothing wrong with fixing supper for Jesus. You just need to be reminded He fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. He can miss a supper. And know that Mary's in the other room listening to Him. I wonder if she knew that maybe the time was short. Sometimes we make those decisions. I tell you, I preached this one time where I am now, and the title of it was Being a Mary in a Martha-like World, and I later learned that one of our sisters was that very morning at home preparing lunch for her family that came from out of town. And I thought to myself, how spiritual is that family? Are they the workers in the kingdom? Listen, folks, what will satisfy you and your and my deepest yearning, our greatest longing, our one need, is God Himself. There's a void in us, and only God fits it. We need to try to stop filling it with nothing. We need to stop the pursuit of happiness and find joy in a faithful relationship with God. I know that's what the Declaration of Independence offers us or says we're supposed to have. But God has something greater. Now, two or three things right here at the end. Thank you for listening. There is a place for some enjoyment in life. Oh, now you can breathe. You know, I'm not taking all the fun out of life. Even Ecclesiastes says you can eat, drink, and be merry, enjoy the fruit of your labors. There's a place for enjoying some things in life. There's some place for some leisure time. There was one occasion that Jesus told the apostles, let's get away and have some leisure time. I think the King James actually uses that word. Let's get away a little bit. But ironically, even on that occasion, it didn't happen because there were so many people surrounding Jesus that he gave them more of his time. That was who Jesus was. There's some time for some bodily recreation. There's even some time for some romance. I think that's why the Song of Solomon's in the book, in the Bible. It's good to be in nature. Get your kids outside. Take some walks in the park. Take a trip. Go to wherever. It doesn't have to be that far away, I guess, if you can't afford it. Enjoy some good songs. Enjoy some good food. Spend time together. A good movie. There's some still, I think, some good movies that can stir your emotions. That's okay. In Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse number 10, when the people had just heard the reading of the word and they began weeping, and there was an occasion where Nehemiah and Ezra were telling the people, not today. It's not time today to weep. This is a day of rejoicing, day of gladness. And Nehemiah told them, eat the fat and drink the sweet. If that's not a reference to barbecue and sweet tea, I don't know what it is. But it's okay. Spend it. Spend it. Now, Gary saved me because I looked at the website and I saw some of the sermons he's been preaching on the use of money. Spend your money on spiritual things. By the way, if you've got a bumper sticker on your car that says we're spending our children's inheritance, go after it. Do it. I'm not sure where we came up with the idea that it's our responsibility to leave just a whole lot of stuff and money to our kids. My kids know they're not going to get much. a bunch of stuff they're going to throw in the trash because it won't be worth anything to anybody else. Spend it on spiritual things. Spend it on the Lord's work. Lay up treasures in heaven. Use your homes. Use your food. Use your cars to serve others. Hospitality. Go to meetings, studies, singings. Look at the women that traveled with Jesus and God remembers them for taking care of him. Listen to Martha and the stories of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. God does commend their hospitality. Philip in Acts 21 and verse 8 kept a group of men, his family, his four daughters. I guess his wife is still around. We don't read about her. Have fellowship with preachers. If you decide on your own to have fellowship with a gospel preacher, do that. Be generous. Acts chapter 4 and verse 32, and you know other passages. Be generous. Give it away. Spend some extra money now and then on somebody you love. Spend some extra money on a spouse or children or parents or friends or brethren. I love the story where Mary takes the ointment and puts it on Jesus, anoints his body with, and the apostles, led by Judas, are over here going, oh, wait a minute. You know, this is a big waste. And what was it, 300 denarii? And if I understand correctly, that's about a year's wages for a common laborer, a denarius a day. She spent a whole year. And I say that, and the husbands are going, wait a minute, Lee. I can't spend a whole year's salary on a gift for my wife. But seriously, make sure you show them some love sometimes by taking your wife out on a date or your anniversary, get away for a while or a vacation now and then, and spending some time with your kids or your parents. It's okay for your kids to spend a little bit on your parents. They looked at me like I was nuts. Anyway, but no, share with them. Be generous. I close tonight by asking, have we spent too much money and time on nothing? Of course we have. Of course I have. And really the question is whether or not I'm going to do any better. Really, the question is, okay, am I going to make any definite changes in my life? We pray that prayer, Lord, help us be better Christians in the future than we have been in the past. And we leave here and nothing changes. Surely, this is one area some things can change. Maybe it's turning off the television an extra hour a day and deciding to read scriptures, or to go visit somebody, or write that card, or fix that meal, or go mow some grass, or to get the family together and go to a gospel meeting. I know how hard that is to do in Indianapolis area. I know that. Not easy in Nashville either to leave the west side and try to get to the east side for a gospel meeting at 7 or 7:30 on a weeknight. You can't always do that. But I'm telling you, get a car full of kids and go to a meeting. Take them to a meeting. If you want to take them and get ice cream afterwards, you can do that too. But spend some time. But one thing we may want to do is repent of our covetousness. That may be a place we need to start. So I end tonight by telling you I don't always know where to draw the line. I know I don't. I'm not drawing it for you tonight. But if you and I are not wrestling with these kinds of issues, then we're not even involved in the fight. You know, because that's how the devil tries us here. Well, I don't know how I could handle the Christians, what they face. I'm not sure I can handle what they faced in the first century and even gave their life. The devil doesn't have to use that with us. He just holds up the carrots, the enticement, or the fake rabbit that runs around the inside of the dog track to get the dogs to run. He just holds that stuff up, that nothing, and gets us all excited about nothing. And God is saying, it's time for you to get excited about me and my work. And if we'll do that, we'll be faithful. Have you got some friends and neighbors that you wonder if they'd ever give up their lifestyle? You know, I had a preacher tell me one time he wouldn't stop and knock on a door if somebody had a boat in the driveway. Because he didn't figure they'd give up their weekend. I thought about that over the years, and I wonder if there's a person in that house that's sick and tired. No, it's empty. Life is empty. Looking for, they don't know yet what yet. But we could open the door. Open their hearts to Jesus. It might not even mean to have to set a cell phone. It'll make some changes in their life to do things that. Maybe tonight you haven't become a Christian. I know people will not obey the gospel because they have a lifestyle. They just don't want to give up. They know they understand what's going to be involved. Now, if you'll think about that carefully, you won't be the man, the farmer who kept building bigger barns and gets to the end of his life, and all of a sudden he's woke up by the realization that he's going to be dead that night. No, isn't it? Think about eternity.
Every now and then, go back and remember, you came into the world with nothing, you'll leave with nothing. We want you to leave with everything. And you can leave with everything if that means leaving with a relationship with God and being able to spend eternity with Him. Please, please think about that. If we can help you tonight in any way in this assembly to obey the gospel, we'd be glad to do that. Will you come as we stand and sing and say something?